Label if you keep guys like that.
No, probably not. Welcome to the Thursday, July 1st edition of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Natural Resource Subcommittee. Today we're continuing with the Department of Environmental Quality, House Bill 1519. And we have Mr. Marsh is here. We'll continue from where we left.
Morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Marsh, the EQ Director, and we're going to resume during Greg Green's presentation of policy directions for everything.
Morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Greg Green. I'm the Air Quality Administrator for the EQ. Yesterday, I reviewed two policy packages for you yesterday. Policy package number 107, which asked for the registration of 5.5 out of 7 FTE to do some preventive work in some of the at-risk communities throughout the state and to do some area and mobile course work. I also reviewed policy package number 108, which asked for the restoration of 2 permitting positions. I have 2 more policy packages that I'd like to talk to you about today. Policy package number 112, which asks for authority to use $1.7 million in federal funds to operate a PM2.5 monitoring network. Right now, this monitoring network consists of about 45 monitors throughout the state of Oregon. One of the concessions that the state was able to get from the EPA when they promulgated this standard was to allow us to collect 3 years of active monitoring data before any designations that were made in terms of the clean data for this new group 2.5. Operating this network will allow us to do that work. If approved, what this policy package will do is it will allow DEQ to actually run the monitoring program versus having the EPA come and do it for us. We would want DEQ to be able to do that because we feel that the data we collect is to make sure that it was correct and complete data. It was complete in terms of making the designations that need to be made. And if for some reason we should have a problem with it, we could be more convinced that the actual data used to make that designation was good data.
Question? The professional services is $641,017. What's that for?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, maybe I can ask Helen Lottridge to help with that question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Campbell, sorry, I didn't hear the question.
On page 178, professional services was $641,000 under services and compliance at 174.
For the record. Mr. Chair, I'm Helen Lottridge, Administrator of the Management Services Division. Give me just a moment here to find the page. $641,817 due to your questioning, Representative. That would be for contract services. Yes, that would be for contract services. Sampling collection. Speaker sampling collection. Contract for sampling collection. No, the analysis?
No.
The analysis of samples collected.
So you'd be like hiring labs then? Is that?
That's correct. You got to answer your question.
That's good enough for now, I guess.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Then the final policy package I'd like to talk to you about this morning is policy package 113. It authorizes the department to fill 83 state positions to operate our vehicle inspection program, the enhanced vehicle inspection program. These positions would replace the contracted positions given us through our last legislative body. The specific number of positions was actually developed to maintain a certain level of customer service. Our goal in the program has always been that when a customer comes in to get their car inspected, we would like to be able to have them in and out of the program in 15 minutes. Approval of this policy package would allow us to operate the program a little bit cheaper and a little bit more efficiently. Right now, we are experiencing some additional training costs associated with training the contracted personnel because normally the turnover rates from these personnel are higher than they are with state personnel. And when we have these higher turnover rates, when we have higher training rates, we have higher service costs in terms of the uniform equipment that we have to provide these contracted inspectors. So we would like to hire state employees to operate this program for us. And with that, I'll be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Sure.
Question there from us, I'd
like to back up to beginning slides, I guess. Even have to go back here, but I'm just checked again this morning with Coos County's road department and the fine they received for their air quality on their crusher. And it brings to my mind how the program works. I know of two fines that were issued, one to the county and one to a private individual. And I believe, and I think they're pretty well documented, they simply did not know there was a permit required on the crushing machine. They had permits for their asphalt batch plants and the other permits for their crushers. And I'm concerned for two reasons. Number one, is the word out there? Does everyone know that the permits are required for all these, for this equipment? And I guess my second question is, is there any special consideration given if they were in compliance except for the fact that they did not have a piece of paper? And did they get the permit as soon as they realized that it was in need? But the other thing that I'm concerned about is how long it takes to resolve these issues. This issue has been going on, I think, for over 6 months, or right at 6 months at least. And it just seems that the longer these things wait, the more they build up, the more stress on not only your department, but the other entities, whether it's private or public. And I guess it's not resolved yet from what I found out this morning. So I would like some response on if there needs to be more education to the public of what is required and why we aren't able to resolve these issues faster.
Mr. Chair, representing Metro, I can't talk that specific issue to you, but I will get you some information on it, but I can answer your questions in general. It's not uncommon when we find a violation with a facility to find out that they didn't do something simply because they didn't know that it was required. And we do put a great deal of effort into working with as many trade associations, with working with industrial associations and a variety of different organizations and companies to try to make sure that our rules are clear, that they're understood, and that they are available to as many people as we can humanly get them out to. When we do find a problem with companies, one of the issues that we've raised in terms of the very limited resources we have is that often these type of things do take a long time simply because we do try to work with the company as closely as we possibly can to make sure that all the factors involved in the situation are out on the table and that we aren't fighting them or taking enforcement action against the company for something that's not warranted. Unfortunately, if for some reason we are forced to look at cutbacks in the program, one of the things that may have to go with the amount of time that we are able to spend with these organizations, because it is a burden for us in terms of financial impact, just as much as it is to them. So we do try to work with them as much as possible. If you'd like for me to, I can find you some specific information out about this action. I can come and talk to you about that.
I would appreciate it if you could.
Thank you.
So move forward. Next, Mr. Chair, we'd like to move to the waste management packages, and I'd like Mary Wall, the division manager for the waste management, to team up with that table to discuss them.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mary Wall. I'm administrator of waste management and cleaner for DEQ. I'm planning to talk to you about four packages today. The first is package 115 that deals with gas station tanks. The second is 116 that deals with home heating oil tanks. And the third is 118 that deals with the Umatilla depot. And the fourth that isn't on this list yet is number 303, which is a cross-media contaminated sediment package. So I'll start with 115. And actually, you dealt earlier in the week with the subject of this one, and so all I need to do is just mention, if I could, the environmental impact of this one, the environmental results because of the support that this committee had for this package. And essentially, the upgrades and leak cleanup efforts protect groundwater, surface water, soil, and human health. An example of the kind of protection that you'll get because of the support of this package is, if you remember, we talked about Pineville and some of the problems that were happening in Pineville as a result of some vapor problems from tanks. And these are the sorts of things that we will be able to work on because of this package. So I'll move on then to 116. You also dealt with this with a compromise bill, House Bill 3107. So this issue has also been dealt with already by this subcommittee. I won't go into any of the details on it unless there are questions on it. This one is both an environmental and an economic issue. There are a lot of homeowners with these problems, and the bill that you already dealt with addressed those issues. It was a compromise bill that we worked out with lots of people before it came to you, and so this one's been dealt with. Moving then to number 118, which is the Umatilla Depot. You heard a presentation by Wayne Thomas, who's the director of the section manager for the depot project in the eastern part of the state. The purpose of this package is to make sure that we have the DEQ oversight and compliance assurance that we need as this facility is built. There is a hazardous waste permit for the incinerator at the depot, and the people that we're asking for in this package, three positions, a manager, two permitting staff, and a compliance officer, are existing positions made permanent. The funding is entirely from the U.S. Army, and so this one is fairly straightforward in terms of funding. You heard a lot about it already, and
sure.
Existing positions made permanent. In light of the fact that this is a temporary operation, I'm not understanding the rationale there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, it's a good question. And it is temporary, but it's very long-term temporary, if you will. The work will go on until our estimate is at least 2007. So given that it wasn't a two-year or a four-year event, we thought that permanent made more sense than limited duration.
So we need to expand our vocabulary to
short-term permanent. If there were an in-between, Representative Jensen, that would fit this one, but since it is 2007. Okay. Hello?
While we're getting back on the packing here, could I ask
caller.
A little bit of additional information.
Absolutely.
How is the department tracking the litigation that is currently taking place in Utah on their facility there and the problems that they seem to be having? And is that going to have any possible impact on where we're going or how we're going to get there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I'm not personally familiar with the current status of the litigation in Utah. We are tracking it, though, both from our office of Wayne Thomas heads and the Attorney General is tracking it also, so we can give you some update on the litigation. We are very much aware of what's going on in each of the other facilities around the country and the status of their progress toward decontamination. We are probably a little bit ahead of the other facilities in terms of getting ready to perform the destruction activity. Controversial issue that we, well, there are two controversial issues we expect over the next year. One is, of course, the issue of preparedness for emergencies, and we're working together with the communities and the emergency management, the federal agencies, to develop a review process to make sure that we get ahead of that. And that's to satisfy a condition in the permit that the governor has to certify that they're ready before any burning activities can take place there. And that's above and beyond what happened at Tooele or the other facilities, so far as we know. The second controversial issue is the Army is reconsidering whether to build the so-called Dunnage incinerator, which takes care of the solids left from the decontamination process. And they are making a decision in August of this year to determine whether to go forward with that. And that is a national decision, as we understand it, that they're going to, at the current time, they're accumulating materials at Tooele and the other facilities and have not commenced burning of them. They have stopped construction of the Dunnage incinerator here at Umatilla temporarily until they make that decision. They will need a major permit modification from us if they decide to not to build that, and we have told them that they cannot take that material off-site. So there is, those are the two issues that to some extent are at play in other parts of the country and we'll be tracking this year.
Your answer to this would have been one of my follow-up questions. So I'll keep them there. So.
First time, Jensen, do we need to write a We Are Not Amused letter? Or, obviously, this plays into a national question about whether incineration or other neutralizing treatments are appropriate, but it seems to be in the middle of the stream that we're having a reconsideration about which horse to ride.
It certainly, Mr. Chair, causes me a lot of concern with the policy that that we have and we're proceeding with. And I think we need to, monitor this very carefully. And I think I'm not impressed. It's not inappropriate. It's possible.
Well, it seems to me that we heard from the individual charged with management of the disposal program that we have a ticking clock, if not a ticking bomb, regarding the canister ages and the instability of material storage.
I think, Mr. Chair, that's right. I don't think anyone can give us a good answer of when, not if, but when, one of those canisters is going to go boom.
Mr. Chair, if I may just clarify one thing. The Dunnage incinerator only relates to the solids, like casings and
the inert, but contaminated material.
The Army is not reconsidering the disposal method of incineration for the liquid, you know, the most dangerous components.
So someone undoubtedly is going to make the suggestion that we landfill that material.
We are concerned both about what the alternative practice would be, about not taking the problem off-site, and about the effect of the reconsideration on the damage on the timetable for ultimate destruction.
And I'm certain that that's been expressed in clear terms.
Very clear terms to the Army.
I think Representative Jensen, I'd love to make a copy of the correspondence.
Okay.
I think, if I might, just one other concern that I have with this, and that I think you alluded to, is that every time these things come along, which seems to be pretty normal in some of these federal projects, it slows the timetable down and delays when we are going to reach the final phase of this. And I would be interested in any kind of projections that the department might have about what this is doing to the ultimate timetable on this issue.
Glad to do that.
It is kind of an interesting comparison that they can be all over us over here, so when we talk about weapons of mass destruction, we can't do much about it. But one of the questions I have is relative to this issue of how prepared we have, what kind of preparedness we provided to the citizens out there. Because if you go to Israel, every person in that country has a protection packet that has appropriate gas masks and coverage materials and sealing agents and all this sort of stuff. But the last thing I saw on national television was just outright embarrassing. Are we going to have protection for these folks out there before this whole process begins?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, there is, of course, an emergency preparedness plan. There are aspects of
it. That's not that stop plan thing, is it?
It includes. The plan does include materials, including self-activating radios for all of the residences in the impact zone. There have been delays in the distribution of that material and in the training and so forth. This is exactly why the Environmental Quality Commission put the condition on the permit that they have to satisfy the governor that the emergency preparedness plans are not only written but in effect before the decontamination, before any incineration, including surrogate agents, begin sometime in 2001.
Mr. Chairman, I can do a follow-up on that. What exactly is the governor asking for? Is he asking for that kind of equipment? Because, I mean, there are suppliers in Israel who will deliver you these kits, express mail. And so are we demanding that kind of protection?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'm not exactly sure what the comparison will be, but I will be glad to provide a highlighted copy of the plan that shows what kind of equipment will be available both to residences, schools, and other facilities.
I'm going to hand people tape recorders with a pre-recorded warning and then a song like "Good Night, Irene," because it was 30 mile an hour east wind.
You have so many seconds.
Yeah, for 12 minutes.
I know.
Just trying to write a note.
I'm a worrier.
Certainly not trying to evacuate anybody.
In relationship to the governor's and the department's sign off on this, in the preparedness sort of thing, one of the initial things that was supposed to be put in place for preparedness was pressurization of the schools. And I think we mentioned in the previous meeting that there is a Head Start school that is literally at ground zero in this program that does not have any provisions for. And I'm wondering if anyone in the department or the executive department anywhere is raising the red flag on this little Head Start school with some 40 students in it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I apologize if we didn't get back to you on that. I will make sure that we find that out. That would be in the province of Oregon Emergency Management.
Yes.
And you know, I'll make sure that we get that information to you.
Thank you.
I would echo the comments of Representative Jensen. I just don't think that we should leave unamplified the department's concerns about the damage disposal. Looking forward.
Moving there, then, Mr. Chair, to package number 303 on contaminated sediments. There are actually two efforts here that DEQ is leading at this point. This is a real significant environmental problem that's had a great deal more effort and attention in the last 4 or 5 years. In Oregon, the two key areas right now are Coosa and Portland, and in Portland there are a couple different projects, the Portland Harbor Cleanup and the look at contaminated sediment disposal that occurred at Ross Island. It's critical environmental work. It also has important economic ties. First, the contaminated sediment disposal, what we are doing there at Ross Island is assessing the impacts and what to do about the contaminated sediments that were disposed there. Portland Harbor cleanup's already going on up and down the river banks. There are 15 sites that we have agreements with. We're assessing another 50 sites. And the cleanup itself is moving into the harbor, and we're assessing what to do about the sediments. The cleanup there is the single biggest cleanup, of course, going on in Oregon. Both efforts are long-term efforts to protect water bodies. What we're looking at for in this package is 8 positions, primarily technical positions, and some public involvement, intergovernmental coordination, because there are so many players in this and so many people who need a voice in what happens in the river.
Well, there's a question that everyone that's ever theoretically done a dry dock operation in the harbor or maintenance of the barrels or any of those things potentially contributed to the contamination problem. How are we going to ascribe accessibility to the cleanup?
Mr. Chair, that's a question that gets asked every time we talk to one of the responsible parties in the harbor, and especially when we go to people that we haven't yet worked with. What we have found in Portland Harbor is that there are some areas where there are elevated levels of contamination that aren't fairly easily attributable to sites. But off the sites that we're working on, for instance, off El Patacam or Northwest Natural or some of those, the very high elevated levels are right off those sites in a lot of cases. There still will be some mixed areas, and there's still questions that we're working on about what came down the river and got deposited from other places. But there's not a big contamination mix or soup in the harbor. There are actually some areas that are fairly distinct and fairly easy to tie, if you will, or at least it appears to be tied to what's on the bank.
So there are plumes, and you can describe them. Are there any situations that would lead you to believe that the orphan site fund would have applicability here?
Mr. Chair, there are. And we have said from the outset in this one that we will look at the orphan site account for some limited amount of money for Portland Harbor. And part of it is that what the state has done is clean up first and then cost recover second. That's what we did at McCormick and Baxter. That's what we did in East Multnomah County, because there are areas where it won't be as clear as right off some of these sites, and especially because there are all the questions about what's coming from upstream into the harbor, that there may be some clear cases where it's not clear what the source is, and we need to send orphan site account money until it is more clear. Even with that, cost recovery is a real likelihood if we send orphan site account money and then can later attribute the contamination to a source. Because it doesn't appear, if there's any good news in Portland Harbor right now, it's that it isn't just one big soup in the harbor, but it is somewhat attributable, and it looks like we'll be able to sort most of it.
community welcomes for some Thompson. And
I want to go to the other harbors.
Let's stay at Portland for another minute, and then we'll go to the other harbors. Representative Jackson.
Just a question of curiosity. What, if any, fines have been levied in relationship to the Lab Island or whatever? Has there been any financial penalties or such against anyone?
Again, Mr. Chair, Representative, are you asking if there have been penalties against Ross Island or against anybody in the harbor?
In relationship to the topics that are present here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I'd have to get back to you to look at. There are 70 sites that we're talking about in Portland Harbor, so I'm sure that over time.
Oh, Ross Island.
Ross Island, there again, I'll have to get back to you because we were looking at a violation, and I have to figure out how far, I have to look and find out how far it is in the process. Can you answer it now?
Mr. Chair, there has been one fine to date against the Ross Island Company for the illegal disposal of solid waste that that exceeded what they were authorized to dispose of, which was basically clean fill and sand. And some of the material that they disposed of in the lagoon as part of their reclamation permit responsibilities did contain organic material or metals or other inappropriate materials, and we have I have assessed a penalty against Ross Island for that. That's still, they have a right, of course, to come back and try to convince us that they don't deserve it. So that's still under process. There may well be other penalties as a result of further investigation that's going on.
But nothing else really in the past tense.
Mr. Chair, I don't, much of the contamination in Portland Harbor is a result of 100 plus years of industrial activity. So most of that was not discovered, so and is not attributable to ongoing operations. So there would be no way in which we could assess a penalty against much of that. If anything has occurred, if we determine that anything has occurred in the years since the laws have been in effect, then of course there could well be.
Okay.
The case of Portland Harbor, and if I remember right, state has charged a submersible land fee for a property at the bottom of the river, am I correct? For leases on property at the bottom of the river.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, for some activities that have taken place in the harbor, private activities, there have been leases granted underwater leases from the Division of State Lands. Not for the deposition of the material that we're talking about.
Let me ask along my line of questioning because I'm not sure the answer. If the Department of State Lands has taken ownership of that property and they have been charging a lease fee for it, are not they the owners of all submersible lands in the state, and shouldn't they be the person that, or the entity that ultimately should pay the cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, there are a couple different situations for the Department of State Land or Division of State Lands, and legal people will have to really get to the answers. But the two answers are, for the river bottom, it looks like it's a different liability case if the state owns property solely for sovereignty reasons. But in other cases where they are managing those properties and taking fees and lease fees and that sort of thing, then it's an entirely different question. And at least one of these sites, they have already said that they will contribute their lease fees to the cleanup costs. And this is one where we worked with, it was a prospective purchaser agreement where a company came in and bought the property and contributed a bunch of money to the cleanup, and DSL, because they were receiving lease fees or would receive lease fees, also stepped up and are paying part of that cost. but the legal Department of Justice is trying to sort out the liability and ownership, but at least at this point, we're not looking to DSL to pay for the cleanup in the harbor. And part of it is because when you do cleanups, you essentially own your plume. So you have, if you have a plume coming off your property, you own the plume, if you will, and the problem from it, wherever it goes. So if that plume moves on to somebody else's property, be it DSL because they own the bottom, or your neighbor, the plume is yours to worry about. And that's the case at a lot of these sites.
One last question then. But if that person who owned the plume is gone, then the obvious owner then becomes the Department of State Land. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, it isn't 100% clear that the Department of State or the Division of State Lands becomes the liable party because they, in the cases where they own it solely for reasons of sovereignty. And that's the question that the Department of Justice is looking at.
Thank you very much.
For sure.
Sure.
President Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned Coos Bay. Are there other enforcement sites in Oregon, Coos Bay and otherwise, going on right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, do you mean are there other sites where we're doing enforcement against somebody, or do you mean are there other sites where we're doing cleanup, like in Coos Bay? There are, in Coos Bay, there were originally 5 sites that EPA was looking at for listing on the national priorities list, and it's reduced, I believe, now to 4, and one of those is a voluntary cleanup site that they pulled out of the consideration at all. The others signed orders, so they're not, and it's an enforcement site, if you will, but it's not one that is in the traditional view of an enforcement site. They're just signed up on orders. So the cleanups are proceeding. I'd have to look to see if there have been fines over time for activities at those sites that are, you know, among the ones that were brought in Coos Bay.
Other sites in Oregon? Other sites in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, if you mean are there other sites where sediments are an issue, there will be other sites, and there are probably some right now that I'm not thinking of, but there are sites where material has gotten into a creek bed or into the sediments from sandblasts or other things that we are looking at. There aren't any that are right now being considered for instance, the National Priorities List.
That's very cool. I thought I've been reading about one in Newport.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nestor, there is a site in Newport. I don't know the name of it right now. I can get it and get right back to you and come talk to you about the one that's there. I mean, these sites, sediment sites, are getting a lot of attention right now. The science is emerging. It's becoming clear how to look at them. Portland Harbor will advance that a lot in terms of what it takes to clean them up and what levels it takes to clean them up. And there are other sites that are coming to light as well in the harbors and in the creeks or rivers.
Sure, I'm not real sure yet. So we have 4 active sites in Coos Bay and 1 that I'm aware of in Newport. There's no other sites that are active at this point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, there are almost 400 cleanup sites, so I have to go look at the list and see which ones of them are on rivers or in bays, and it sounds like that's the question you're asking. And I can get the full list of all of the nearly 400 cleanup sites that we're doing right now and try to figure out which ones of those might affect sediments. And I suspect there are quite a few of them, but you know, it's not the majority by any stretch.
Okay.
The name of the shipyard, Troy Marine. That is one of the questions that I came up here for is the cost estimate for all the other shipyards, because those are the main sediment sites along most of the rest of the estuaries. Mm-hmm. The cost estimate of what it might cost just to evaluate the potential is for dollars it may cost the state in the future. The Troy Marine site could lead to be another problem similar to the push-up dam that was down in your area, where it becomes one of the keys for EPA to come in and
say DEQ is doing its job is what I'm worried when actually you guys have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, the cost of assessment on these sites and looking at these sites initially, and especially when EPA comes in, it does raise the question, and in Portland Harbor, it clearly raised the question about whether it then is a site that's eligible for or should be on the national priorities list. The fact that we do the assessment, I mean, people are looking at sediment issues in any case. So the question is, how do we handle them, and can we keep them at with state leaves and avoid the NPL list for some of them?
Good day. I had a bill in the legislature, I believe it's in this committee, that I'm not sure exactly what the dollar value is now, but I think it was $200,000 to go out and take sediment samples that allowed DEQ to go out and evaluate what the cost was for all the shipyards along the coast, which I believe was a preventive almost bill so that we could say we were moving toward cleaning up those sediments. And if we don't, I'm worried that EPA, especially after the Hoy Marine situation, may use it as a triggering mechanism to come into the state and take over.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that, the piece of assessment, which was the subject of Representative Thompson's bill, is a critical first step. It takes away a lot of the uncertainties and at least lets people know how big the problem is or an initial idea of how big the problem is, and takes away some of the black hole concerns, if you will.
Thank you.
Thank you. Finishing off with this package, then, there are, for Portland Harbor Cleanup, there are five positions, five FTE. Four of those are what we call NRS4s. They're project managers, a toxicologist, and a technical coordinator. His job, essentially, is to make sure that the technical pieces in the harbor make sense, so that we're doing 70 sites and that we're looking at all of those consistently, that we don't have issues where we do source control at one site that's not timed right, so that we have a recontamination problem. And mostly it's so that we do the sampling in whatever way we can to avoid having to do the same thing twice. You could go to each one of those sites and do the work at each one at a time. If we do it collectively and time it right and make sure that the site work is integrated, then we can get some efficiencies of scale, if nothing else, and we can do one job instead of several, and that's what this position is intended to do. The funding for this is cost recovery. For the contaminated sediments disposal, we talked about the purpose a little bit before. Basically, we're trying to assess the current conditions and figure out what has to happen because the contaminated sediments were disposed there. We're also looking at options for interim and long-term disposal. As you all know, that's a major problem in any harbor area. This package has 2.75 FTE, three positions. One of those is a high-level technical position who would be a sediment specialist, essentially. One is a toxicologist, and the other is a public information representative because there are so many public questions about contaminated sediments. The funding here is receipts authority. That's it on my packages, unless anybody has questions.
What would be the triggering mechanism to access the open site funding as you know?
The triggering mechanism is looking at what looking at the facts of any situation that comes up in Portland Harbor, and we try to. There are only 35 orphan sites in the state, so not very many sites trigger the orphan site. In this one, we'll look at what has to be done, how many. If there is information that suggests that there is a source or isn't, if there's no source for contamination and the work needs to proceed, then the state has said that we would be willing to put some orphan site money on the table to advance the work and cost recover later until we know what the source is. But the key triggering factor is the environmental priority of the work that's in front of us and whether there is a responsible party that we can look to for cost recovery, or there isn't somebody there to do the work.
Chair, just to amplify, I think a complicating factor in Portland Harbor situation is that there are so many sites on which work needs to go on more or less at the same time in order to get a full picture of what the problem is. And then what may happen is that there are some so-called hotspots where it isn't clear who's responsible. And I think that what we're looking at is if we can't find clarity up front, then we're prepared to pay to dip into the orphan site account to get those sites moving along so that the whole picture still can get painted and the whole process move ahead. So we would still look for cost recovery if that were possible.
I glanced here and I didn't see it. Maybe it's because I haven't been down here, but any estimate of what the total dollars are we're looking at for the Portland Harbor area?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, there aren't any estimates yet for the total cost. We are still looking to figure out which of these sites are the major sites. The first 6 months was $500,000 to put the entire package together, the Portland Harbor Sediment Management Plan, which talks about sediment guidelines. The remedial investigation, which is the next major phase, and that'll start in March, where implementation of the remedial investigation really gets underway, is probably a $3 to $5 million job by the time it's finished, and that's a couple years. So it's a major expense, and the primary source of funding for that is cost recovery. So the responsible parties in the harbor will be picking those up.
Help me understand, that's just to get all the assessments. That's not to get it all cleaned up. That's just assessment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, it's more than just assessment. It's an investigation to really the extent of the plume and those and how much has to be done and what you have to do for sediments to clean them up. But there is major investigation to be done in this one, and it's a multi-layered project. And yes, that is just the investigation part. That's not the cleaning up part of it.
Can I ask one last follow-up? Do you have even a wild guess of what we're looking at in this area? Take your biggest parameter you can.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I don't have it yet. We flat out don't know how extensive it is yet, and I don't know the full cost of it. It's a major undertaking. It's 6 miles of harbor. It's the most industrialized part of the river, and there are 70 sites with, as Director Marks mentioned, 100 years of industrial activity. So there are some of those sites where there is extensive contamination, and we don't have an idea yet of the full cost.
Can I make a statement? I don't think the state of Oregon has realized what potential cost is, not only this, but all these sites here in Coos Bay and up and down the coast is. I think when they see the numbers, they're going to be staggered. It's going to be a major drain on somebody. You're optimistic as to you're going to be able to defray that cost back on the owners. I'm not as optimistic because I believe most of those people are long gone, or once they think that they're going to be involved, they're going to make themselves neutral as they can, or just literally leave the area. So consequently, it's all going to fall back on the state. I think that we need to get this done, get at least an estimate so we know where we're going.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, the one thing in the Portland Harbor, and I don't disagree with you that it becomes incredibly difficult for companies to step up to these kinds of costs. I would mention that 10 entities in the Portland Harbor area that have formed what they call the Portland Harbor and have stepped up and done some of the initial work already. They were the ones, 10 of them put up the $500,000 to do the initial work to get things underway. So they clearly it's not what they want to get up in the morning and do is take on a Superfund site, but they have stepped up and so the work has at least been kicked off.
Sure. I'm
I guess. Very silly. I'm concerned when you talk about the plumes and where that contaminant can move to and the potential problems. I don't know if you've done a study. I'd be really interested if those contaminants are moving now, and if it doesn't make a lot more sense in most cases just to encapsulate it or contain it where it is so it doesn't move in the future. I'm concerned that it sounds like we're talking about removing it, and then you create another problem someplace else, and you have to move it very far. It's extremely expensive if you can even find a site to move it to. I think we need to be very careful that we don't create a monster here. Maybe, you know, we can't change what was done in the past, but how we deal with what was done in the past, I think, is, regardless of what Representative Thompson was saying, this thing could turn into a total monster, or we could work with EPA or whoever we have to work with, and where we can, encapsulate where it is, contain it where it is, and get on with life.
Mr. Representative Messerly, in fact, those are good questions, and the companies and other entities, they're not all companies, there are public agencies or public entities involved in Portland Harbor too. First of all, not all of it is going to get moved. In fact, not, you know, it's not necessarily even the majority of the highway will get moved. A lot of times it's best to leave them in place. And the piece of good news in Portland Harbor is that it appears that the high concentrations are just off some sites, rather than that they've moved all the way out into the middle of the channel or in the middle of the harbor. So a lot of it is very close to shore. Generally, in these kinds of cleanups, it's a mix of remedies or fixes, if you will, at the end. And some of it may need to get moved, but as you said, that's a very difficult thing to do, to find where to put it afterwards. But a lot of it gets either treated in place or buried in place, if you will, capped with an appropriate cap, and then restrictions on what can happen there. You can't put pilings through it, or some kind of restriction can be put on it. Keep it where it is. So it doesn't all, it's not a matter of digging up the entire 6 miles and moving it somewhere, because you're right, it would be a monster job to find a place to put it, and extremely costly, and maybe not even the best environmental option.
Follow-up,
one brief question. I mean, but this is a huge problem for future dredging. Portland Harbor is an area that needs to be dredged, and those contaminants obviously are in there. Is that a factor figured into Army Corps of Engineers dredging plans at present?
Chair Representative Thompson, we're working closely with all kinds of people about the dredging question, including the Corps of Engineers. They have a site in the Portland Harbor, and they're totally involved in the dredging. What we have said is we would like to make sure that the cleanup and the dredge work, whatever has to happen, because it's not just the deepening that may happen at some point in the Willamette as well as the Columbia, but also around the docks, people do annual or semi-annual maintenance dredging. So we're trying to make sure that this work proceeds fast enough that it can be harmonized with dredging that needs to happen. And if any needs to be picked up because of cleanup reasons, if we can pick the stuff up as somebody else is picking it up for dock maintenance, then that makes sense, and that's what we're trying to do, is make sure that our information is closely enough tied with theirs and our investigation is closely enough tied that we don't do the same thing twice.
Mr. King?
It would make more art turn habitat for dredging. And I'm really relieved that we've locked up our ticker on the House side in the Constitution, so in the future when we come to Portland Harbor, we might use K-12 funds. Let's do that. I'm supportive of what I'm seeing up here on the Ross Island in terms of, studying it. I think that's the most we can do. But I have the similar concerns, going back to Ross Island, as we just talked about with Portland Harbor, that, like you say, maybe best to leave it there. But, river bottoms are gravel, and those are sieves. And so that means the water's still moving through it. So all that contaminant we're just impacting the velocity of the release, and you might think over time, that at some point downstream we're going to be facing, when you get your study done, and my question is going to be where, how long it takes to do the study part versus then we find out, okay, this is the magnitude of the problem, this is the cost with fixing it up, and that I'm really afraid of the mega dollars.
Mr. Representative, can you raise really important questions in terms of refining the scientific questions to the level that you can figure out what you can leave in place, because some degradation will happen, and it becomes a fairly fine science or technical answer in terms of what you can leave in place, what you can treat in place, what will move or won't move, what kind of cap will keep it. I mean, that stuff will stay there. The reason that there are fairly defined plumes with the very high levels right off these sites is that it appears it isn't moving a lot every year. So some of those contaminants that have built up over decades have stayed right off those sites. There's some mixing, but not like we would have feared going into this. So it's a fairly fine-tuned technical question, what to leave in place, what to move, what to pick up, what to cap, and how much will be great enough over time that you're safe leaving it in place. And that's why, as extensive as it is, the question Representative Thompson asked about the investigation, those are the kinds of questions that are getting asked and answered now so that we don't make a mistake, get to redo this, a decade from now, or create a monster problem, on down the river. And those are questions that some of this is emerging science. There are urban rivers being dealt with like this across the country. This is an important one. We are looking at sediment guidelines here. But if you don't spend a little bit of time, and it is expensive, but if you don't answer those questions now, you can end up doing recontamination or getting to do the job twice. And that's the single biggest thing we're trying to avoid, is doing this job twice. So we are spending the time to figure it out now.
So my question is, about how long it will take, this level of intensity does it take to study before we then get some kind of an understanding of then what do we do with it?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, 2 years, probably 18 months to 2 years for the remedial investigation. And that is what we have done to date in Portland Harbor is record time for coming up with a sediments management plan in 6 months is almost unprecedented. And because people actually, sort of set aside some of the legal questions, and people just decided to fund that 6 month intense effort to try to figure out as much as we could in terms of a framework so that people could all ask their questions now, so we don't, for instance, end up asking a fish question afterwards that we could have answered in this next 18 months. So we're asking those questions now. But to get this level of an investigation done in 18 months to 2 years is going to be record time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd like to correct the record of my colleague when I last mentioned contaminants move through sand and rocks on the river bottoms. And a few years ago, I was talking with the DEQ staff about the lug pumps and do they contaminate the groundwater and this type of thing. And the answer was that they do not, because they tend to seal themselves off with the sediment on things. And in the case of rivers and bays, as coasties call it, I'll paraphrase a little bit, loon poop, but it does seal itself on. You don't see making those contaminants. Stream of the bays.
Mr. Chair, the only other thing I wanted to mention is you had some questions, the committee had some questions to Mike Kortenhoff, and before I leave, he has a letter to the members of the committee answering those questions about the tank program, so I'll leave those with you.
Thank you. Any further questions on any of the programs that we just heard today? Thank you very much. Mr. Marsh, it's my intention that we finish the public hearing by about 10 minutes to go.
Sure.
means that we need to pick the pace up just a little bit.
We'd be glad to do that. I'm going to cover the next two items very quickly. There, Mary went by the cross media packages introductory slide. The first one was the package 303 and contaminated sediments. The second one is package 304 on community solutions. That, I believe we talked about that during the earlier presentation. We've had quite considerable success with some of the community solutions type activities around the state. One of them we talked about yesterday, a related one, is the Lapine situation. And what this package will do is to increase our capability to be able to handle some of those situations as they come up through the community solutions field teams. These folks would work with the field teams that have already been set up, which are basically high-level managers of the different community solutions agencies around the state, and be able to handle more projects and get more successes that are across the board involving the interaction of all the state agencies in more parts of the state. The funding is federal funds that would be transferred from ODOT. The next package is package 305, which involves the continuation of the work of the governor's environmental justice advisory board. There are no new positions here, but it's a $40,000 general fund request. The environmental justice advisory board has recently completed its report. It's about to be issued by the governor, and one of the recommendations would be to continue that board for another biennium, and this would assist their work.
Chair?
Question.
Just a comment on both those two packages. I assume that without these packages, these tasks are being done anyway, such as the livability, community solutions. I assume your staff for years has been working with the local communities and helping them develop programs to do their projects or their developments or whatever. And I would hope, again, with the environmental justice, that that's something that is in your staff orientation and policy and a goal. I'm sure you have a policy relating to that in your organization. I guess what I'm trying to say is that it would seem to me that these kind of activities should be taken care of within normal budgets, particularly for a department of this size.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, you're absolutely right that this is the way we want to do business and increasingly want to do it in the future. The request for the Energy Solutions additional staff is really because of the desire to increase the overall capability of the state agencies involved in the community solutions team to handle more of the kinds of projects that we have. Not that they're going to be fundamentally different or a different type of activity than we're undertaking now for the community solutions efforts, but just to bring them to more communities and faster. So it is, you're absolutely right. We'll continue to work with the community solutions activities as much as we can, and this would help us using federal funds to amplify that further.
Thank you.
Shall we proceed?
Okay, we'll now move to agency management, and Helen Rotrich is joining me at the table to present those two packages.
Thank you. For the record, Helen Rotrich, I'm the administrator of the Management Services Division at DEQ. I hope you'll forgive my weak voice. I'm dealing with a virus that I think I got in this building at one time or another.
got the man very wrong.
I hope she doesn't die.
Yeah.
This not here.
The management service.
I once observed that you could drag a carload of sympathy up to the front door of the facility and couldn't get a nickel for it.
Very
yeah.
Yeah,
nice try.
Yeah.
No cookie. In the management services division, we're responsible for such things as budget and human resources, accounting, health and safety, organization improvement, and information management. And you'll see pages in your handout that describe the packages that are in our governor's budget, and I'm not going to follow those today. Late yesterday afternoon, Mr. Rocco asked me to take a different approach in my presentation to you today, and the reasoning that he gave me was that since Management Services Division does depend on indirect revenues based on the direct labor costs for the rest of the agency, and is therefore directly dependent on decisions that you will make about the packages that you've heard about yesterday and today, that the Management Services Division packages are quite uncertain. And so he and I agreed that probably the best approach for the Management Services Division packages would be to await your decision and then take a look at our highest priorities and decide how we would best invest the revenue that we do have, or where we would need to take other cuts if necessary. So I often think that in management services, we do the type of work where success means that you're invisible. If the tools are all in place and if everything is working well, nobody notices you. But if they're not, then we hear about it. And what we've been hearing about with increasing volume is information management, and that is where we have the greatest shortfall in management services division. Mr. Rockwell has just distributed to you a chart that shows our top information management priorities. Just to give you a very short background, we made some very good investments in planning and in computer systems in the early 1990s. But we've had really very woefully inadequate follow-up. We don't have enough staff to support the systems that we built, and those systems have actually become outdated. We have shortfalls and budget cuts over the last three biennia, and budget cuts tend to hit central services first. And so we have not attended to our computer infrastructure for the last three biennia in the way that would have been best, because we have deferred to more field work such as the Oregon plan. These circumstances, however, are now affecting the technical and management work of the agency because we don't have adequate tools to do our job. If there should be additional indirect revenue or some unexpected gift of general fund, we would select our priorities for information management from the list that you have in front of you. Now, I'd like to just run through each of these very quickly to describe to you the priority and why it's important. The first one on the list is the time accounting, agency-wide time accounting. We have more and more frequent requests for greater accountability and better management tools in the agency. We hear complaints, and you may have also, that we cannot provide enough information on how we spend our time and the revenues by program and by activity. And the solution to that is a robust agency-wide time accounting system. The second item that you see there is desktop computer support. The industry standard is one support person for every 50 desktops. Let me give you an example. In our western region, we have one support person taking care of 150 desktops in six different offices.
So this is really, they were really very far behind in this area. And what happens is that people that we call power users, like technical staff who know a lot about computers, end up filling that gap, and that's not a, an efficient way to do it. The third item that you see there is the Internet. The Internet is becoming the standard of how information is shared and interactions take place among government agencies as well as in private industry. And we have simply worked that in with our other jobs. There's currently one fellow in my division who does all of the Internet hardware and software support in addition to his regular job. And so we need someone to attend to that. System modernization, this is badly needed. Let me just show you one of the slides that I had for these packages. Here's an example. This black screen that you have is what we're dealing with in many of our systems right now. You can see that that's very user unfriendly, and it's really pretty antiquated. It requires a lot of manual support. And what we really need to do is modernize these systems and bring them up to what you see on the right there, which is far more intuitive and would give us better access to our information and have it have more utility for everyone. Then you see environmental data on the Internet. Someday in the future, I would like to see us get to the point where we could get on the Internet, select a geographical area, and find out what the environmental health is of that area for the air and the water and the land, no matter what area we select. And that way, we could know where we need to support our resources in the future. We could share that information easily with other agencies, communities, and the public. And so we would like to take steps toward that future. And the next step that we have a good foundation for now, if we had the financing to go ahead, would be to make sampling information available on the Internet for everyone so that we could use maps and geographic capabilities to share information about what substances have been found in the air, water, and land in any given geographic area. We currently have that sampling information available, but we have it in our possession, but it isn't accessible because we don't have it computerized.
Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And by the way, they were saying nice pin.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, we've heard a lot in this committee as well as others this session about the data that we can compile and is it compatible with other areas or departments that deposit this information, such as DAS. And we've also heard a lot about from some of the other agencies where they were trying to get it in a form where it would be. It would interrelate with others. I don't see in your budget where you folks are doing that. Is that already done, or is there another need that's coming back in a future year where so that DAS or whoever holds all this information is compatible and can be as an overlay for areas and stuff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, this is a huge concern, and the answer is that we're partway there. I believe that the key to being able to share data in the natural resources area, in the environmental area, is geographic location, so that if we all have a standard way of storing the geographic location, latitude, longitude, excuse me, and then if we key on that, then if one agency has information and we have another set, we should be able to link those very effectively if we're all storing the latitude, longitude, or the geographic information data in a standard way. And
we actually have standardized the way we store our latitude, longitude, and we have used a standard that's pretty nationally accepted. I'm not sure that I am getting right at the core of your question, however, let me pause here a moment and see if that gets at it or if I can clarify something.
Well, I think you're heading in the right direction. You know, the scale and the language that they use, so that it's all compatible, whether it's federal government or Department of Ag or Water Resources, or that information has to be compatible so it can be overlaid together.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, that is absolutely the key. I'm currently co-chairing a national committee that is working on environmental data standards, and the very purpose of that group is to get at the question that I believe you're addressing here, and that is how can we best share information not only among environmental agencies but with the public and with anyone else who might need to use it for decision making. And what we're doing is working on data standards so that no matter how we have our information stored or what kind of a system somebody else might have, if we agree on a particular standard for exchanging information, then we can blend it and use all of the information together. So that is the way to go. Now, once you've agreed on a standard, and you still have to make it readily accessible to people so it's not hard to get at. And that's what the Environmental Data on the Internet project would do, is it would put it out there and make it accessible in a real intuitive way where people could just point at a map and be able to bring up the information about substances that are there.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up. I guess what I'm not clear on is when will be there, when will we have this information all compatible. We've had budget items over other budgets where they were doing that right now in the next biennium. And what the sense I'm getting from you is that we're still working on trying to figure out how to do it and what kind of how we should format that data. And I'm wondering if it almost sounds like we've got different departments independently working on this, and that is a concern to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, I'm not sure if you're referring to the geographic information system work. We know what we need to do and how we need to do it. What we lack is the resources to get it running.
I think this interruption, Messerly, your point is that there's a GIS system in the Department of Forestry. There's a GIS system that we directed DAS instructions coordinate. There are GIS requirements and needs in every natural resource.
EOCD, Department of Ag, Forestry, all of them have had.
And
to do with it.
The question is whether or not we have connectivity and transferability. We've heard every agency say we know exactly what we need to do, and it's clear that we're not talking to each other.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, mentally, if I'm right, geographic information is just ultimately shareable, and we have taken full advantage of the state GIS service center. We use their data layers. But we have sampling data about substances that are in the environment. That's probably a data layer that we ought to create and have so that we can share it with other people. But there are a lot of data layers that are shareable. Like when we put our information on the Internet, we won't just use state GIS service center data layers. We'll use data layers that are available out there nationally on the Internet. And not, it would be foolish to create one that already exists somewhere. They're very shareable. And they ought to be shared.
I guess you're referring also to reference points, sampling data, methodology, input parameters, all sorts of different things that are not being standardized. So that you may find that the
longitude and the latitude for references are identical from one GIS system to another.
Maybe data captured, stored, and retrieved is different and not necessarily
compatible with other systems. So we've had data entered in one spreadsheet format that won't translate into another spreadsheet format.
Mr. Chair, usually translating from one format to another, that's getting easier and easier. But as you say, one agency might have different, say, reliability. You know, how confident are we in the data that we have? How did we get it? How accurate is it? And so when you get the data, that way you have an idea of how much you can depend on it. And so part of any kind of data set needs to be a description of how did you get it. Well, you know, was this a volunteer monitor? Was this a lab analysis? What was it? And so that information has to be
there.
Actually, the area that I'm most worried about your information being compatible with is public health service. I mean, that to me is one of the main things that you're going to deal with in the future is you overlay GIS information. We just had a study done on the coast that shows we have one of the highest rates of cancer in the United States, and it's one particular type of cancer. Now, there's something inside that environment that we need to find out is there, and it's not going to be the public health service who probably finds it. It'll probably be DEQ and your information. If we can use that overlap with GIS, we can make through that system, we could probably cut down the time finding out what it is. And I think that's one of the applications that will be applied all over the United States in the future if we can get our information compatible enough.
And no, Representative Mitchell, in response to your observation, it is not Jack Daniels.
How close are we to conclude?
We're just almost there.
Let's get there.
All right. Mr. Chair, one clarification on the line on the chart that says environmental data on the Internet. I do want to clarify that we would not be doing geographic information with it. This is the database. This is the information system that will store the information. It's not geographic information system. We would use somebody else's work set. I'm just going to briefly mention the technical training for our software systems developers. The industry is changing so fast that it's very hard to keep people current, and so we are badly in need of training there. And then the water quality monitoring is very much related to having complete information, and that project would add the biological system sampling, not just the substances, but the biological health information. And with that, I'm going to stop.
That completes our overall presentation to the chair. So further questions, I got me here, we'll be back on Tuesday.
Our intention would be to go directly to work session on Tuesday, listen to all of our recommendations for the CPU budget, and take action with questions on Sunday.
Hey, Chair, aren't we going to have public hearing?
We will have public hearing on work session for the CPU.
Mr. Chair, since that might not be available, could I make a quick comment?
Observations
in the last 4 years working with DEQ and all kinds of projects such as port tanks and including just getting a phone call yesterday on the Hawaii Marine from DEQ. I don't know what's going on the rest of the state, but my personal experience with DEQ has been very positive over the last few years of working with them. And I realize they have limited funds, but their staff has been very good to work with and very progressive-minded. So that's what I wanted to say that. And since I might not be available to come down, here they have.
Thank you, Mr. Council, for joining the committee and for your excellent session. Harbor. Any further business can be for the committee? Hearing nothing, then we are in adjournment until Tuesday.